I call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. Let the record reflect that it is 1:33 p.m. on Tuesday, April 13th, 2021. Present in the room today are Representative Thompson, Representative Carpenter, Representative LeBon, Representative Edgman, Vice Chair Ortiz, Co-Chair Foster, Representative Rasmussen, Representative Josephson, Representative Wool, Representative Johnson, and myself, Co-Chair Merrick. We also have been joined by Senator Rivak. This afternoon, we will take public testimony on House Bills 79 and 80 and introduce and take public testimony on Senate Bill 22 and House Bill 126. It is not my intention to move any of these bills today. Are there any questions on House Bill 79 before we take public testimony? Seeing none, at this time, I'm going to open public testimony on House Bill 79, Sport Fishing Operator Guides, by the administration. Is there anyone online or in the room that would like to testify on HB 79? It looks like first we have Dick Rohner from Kodiak. Please state your name, affiliation, and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Dick Rohner, last name spelled R-O-H-R-E-R. Thank you for the opportunity to comment to the committee. I listened with interest this morning earlier to the Finance Committee's discussion of this bill, and specifically I want to comment about the financing for it. It's interesting to me that there's not a higher fee addressed to non-residents. We have precedent for that on the big game side. I'm a big game guide as well as a sport fish guide. So by comparison, a master registered guide on the big game side, a resident license is $850, a non-resident is twice that, $1,700. Same with an assistant license, which would compare to the sport fish guide license. An assistant big game license fee is $410 for a resident. For a non-resident, it's $820. Of course, these are biennial fees, but I would just point to a commercial fishing crew member annual license fee for a resident is $60. For a non-resident is almost five times that at $280. So as I listen to the discussion about how to fund this saltwater logbook program, seems to me appropriate to charge the non-resident operator and guide at least twice the amount that the resident fisher is paying. These days, I'm primarily a freshwater guide, and I am, even though I'm not involved in saltwater anymore, I am supportive of, as a freshwater guide, paying the license fee and that revenue going to help with the saltwater logbook program. I understand the importance of that program. I would just add a concern that if this license fee for freshwater would be a segue back into a freshwater logbook system, I would be opposed to that. Also have some concerns about the penalty section. If you look at that closely, there's a provision whereby in a any three-year period, if a guide has two violations, the court may revoke his license. That's always seemed pretty severe to me, but I don't have a suggestion at this time how to change that, but primarily concerned about the fees. So thank you for the opportunity to testify. Any questions, I'm happy to answer.
I don't see any questions. Thank you for testifying today, Mr. Rohr. We appreciate hearing from you. Next, in Kenai, we have Roni Harmon. Please state your name, affiliation, and begin your testimony.
Hi, my name is Ron Harmon. I'm from Kenai, Alaska, and I'm non-affiliated. My testimony today is House Bill 79. My first concern is rule number four. I don't think it says rule, it just says number four. And it says that the guides satisfy all requirement rules adopted by the Board of Fish. And I think that should read, guides should adopt the rules of the Constitution of Alaska, AF, ADF, and G. And at this particular time, no Board of Fish rules. And the reason is the Commissioner of Fish, when he does these fish board meetings, he says, when we do a new rule of the fish board reasoning, that I must be included to rule over the Board of Fish based on the king salmon return and the maximum sustained yield. I think that means he's kind of dictating over the Board of Fish rules, and when he does that, he can only rule on licensed people, and guides are not licensed, charter boats are not licensed, but commercial fishery is licensed, and that's where he rules, is on licensed fishermen. Also, current guides and charter boat fish for free. They take resources from Alaska's water and the bottom of the ocean, almost zero income to the general fund. I want to remind you that 6.4 million guides frequent Alaska, and just on the Kenai Peninsula alone, they take 3 million fish out of the Kenai and 3 million fish out of the Kusilov. They fish 24/7 nonstop, catch and release. That is a blood sport. Charter boats fish for free, the Alaskan resource. They have taken over the last 20 years, $44.310 billion worth of fish off the bottom of the Kenai Peninsula burl alone. The dip net fishery, just on the Kenai Peninsula, they take 543 million fish a year, zero income to the general fund. Retail price of that fish is $25 a pound, and that's real value out of the grocery store. So they get the real price, $25 a pound, and they get it all. $543 million, that doesn't go to the general fund. Currently, Alaska marijuana growers, the feds, they collect $800 a pound from Alaska growers. The feds, they know how to make revenue. 60 years now, Alaska politicians are still giving its revenue away for free. I asked the Division of Licensing why big game guides are licensed and why fish guides and charter boat aren't licensed. They said they don't know why. I asked Doug Lang why fish guides and charter boats are licensed and big game guides aren't, and why the dip net fishery is a free permit, but the commercial permit is 20 to a couple hundred grand, depending on the outcome of our fishery back in the old days. But perhaps it's all just lobbyist money. I don't know. They seem to control the $14 million a year that the Kenai Peninsula fishery produces, but you haven't seen a federal general fund income for them probably 20 years now. Just imagine the amount of revenue that's possible if the politicians put a minimum value of $3 a pound on any fish taken on the oceans in the Kenai Peninsula. Like the feds, the value of their marijuana, $800 a pound, so could be the fishery, $3 a pound minimum, then the price of fish would be back on the market again. But really, this is a commerce problem that was started by Don Young back in 1975, and I'd like the legislature to take this old problem that's breaking Alaska's economy and just change it so to suit Alaska's needs. And that old legislation was called D2-1 legislation. Do away with the Board of Fish, and let's get this Alaska economy going again. Thank you for my testimony.
Thank you. We have a question from Representative Wohl.
Thank you, Madam Coach.
Sure.
Not so much a question, and I know the caller listed a lot of facts and figures or a lot of figures. I don't know if they're verified, but the marijuana tax is paid to the state. It's not paid to the federal government. The state receives that money.
Thank you, Representative.
Oh, that's even better. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Carman. We appreciate you testifying today. Next, we Insel Dotna, Executive Director of the Kenai River Sports Fishing Association, Mr. Ben Moore. Please state your name, affiliation, and begin your testimony.
Hi, good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the Finance Committee. Thanks for having this hearing today. For the record, my name is Ben Moore. I'm the Executive Director of the Kenai River Sport Fishing Association, KRSA. I'm justifying today to register KRSA's support for HB 79 as it was originally proposed by the governor. As you've heard earlier today, the Saltwater Logbook Program meets an obligation for reporting on our activities related to the Halibut Treaty and the Salmon Treaty. The data generated and reported out are not optional. They're necessary to meet our treaty needs and to provide information needed for sustainable science-based management of Alaska's saltwater fisheries. Hunters and sport fishermen have long supported the user pays model for fishing game conservation. It's a tradition that goes back over 100 years in the United States. Accurate information coming into managers and treaty negotiators is essential to making good calls in Alaska's fisheries. And as a beneficiary of those management calls and treaty positions, it's fitting that the user of those resources cover their costs. But this is also why we support keeping freshwater out of the bill, and it's the reason for our opposition to the amendments provided by the earlier committee. Under the philosophy of user pays, user benefits, comes the desire for specificity. There's no reason why a pike guide in Fairbanks should be paying for a program required for a charter guide in Ketchikan. Establishing guide registration fees under the guise of programs necessary for treaty obligations like the Saltwater Logbook looks to be somewhat inappropriate. I would suggest that if the body wants to create a new fee for small businesses like the charter sector to operate under, that should be taken up as its own proposal, not slipped in under required and otherwise broadly supported program. The reporting requirements under the Salmon Treaty and the Halibut Treaty are unlikely to change, and managers are going to continue to need data. The associated costs are likewise unlikely to disappear. And as Alaska's budget belt tightens, programs like treaty obligations could attempt to rely on general funds, or Alaska's sport fishing communities can continue the proud tradition of paying our own way. While KRSA can't speak for all charter guides, we can support the philosophical underpinnings behind the user pays model, and accordingly we voice our support for the governor's version of this bill. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Mr. Moore. We have a question from Representative Wohl.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. What are your thoughts on non-resident and resident guiding fees? Should they be different? Should the non-resident guide pay more than the resident guide?
You know, through the chair, thank you, Representative Wohl. The guide sector has actually been looking at this on the Kenai River recently, too, as the costs for a guide license on the Kenai changed. We used to have a difference between out-of-state guides and in-state guides. Those prices are now equal between the two sectors. I might suggest asking parks why those fees are now equal. I have the feeling that it has something to do with obligations under the Commerce Clause of the Constitution to operate businesses and where they're based. But that's just a guess.
Follow up? I'm trying to infer from your answer how you feel about it. Do you support different rates for resident and non-resident guides?
I'd have to, through the chair, Representative Wohl, I'd have to look at the details of it. I think, I haven't really given that a whole lot of thought. I have given quite a bit more thought to the difference on licensing between in-state and out-of-state anglers, but for businesses, it's a different question.
Thank you. Further questions? Thank you, Mr. Moore. We appreciate your testimony. I see no one else online. Is there anyone in the room that wishes to testify on HB 79? Seeing none, I'm going to close public testimony. Further questions from the committee? Seeing none, we will hear House Bill 79 at a future meeting. Amendments are due to my office by the end of the day on Saturday. Next up is House Bill 80, Sport Fish Hatchery Facility Surcharge by the administration. Are there any questions before we open public testimony? Seeing none, I will open public testimony. Is there anyone in the room that would like to testify on HB 80? Seeing none, we'll go online. First in Juneau, we have Ron Somerville from Territorial Sportsman. Mr. Somerville, please state your name, affiliation, and begin your testimony.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Ron Somerville. I'm representing the Territorial Sportsman Inc. here in Juneau. My address is 8126 Keegan Street in Juneau. The Territorial Sportsman strongly supports HB 80, as we have supported the surcharge in the past. It has greatly helped our local fisheries. You have a lot of information I've checked online from people supporting this, so I'm not going to relate all of that because you already have it. But I'd like to add a couple of things, which were similar when I was testifying on SB 60, that, again, this is a situation where the users are willing to pay for the extra benefits. Even if they don't benefit themselves, the concept of this type of program on a statewide basis is really important. And it's important here because, in our case, our king salmon fisheries in Southeastern has been abysmal. The Taku and Stikine systems have been essentially closed for fishing in salt water for the last 6 or 7 years. Thus, as a result of that, our king salmon fishing is virtually gone, except for what we get from the hatchery program supported by funds from this surcharge. The other thing I wanted to mention was that there's been virtually no complaint about the surcharge through all the years we had, even though it was initially designed to build two hatcheries in Anchorage and Fairbanks for the sportsmen. So I'm saying this is a win-win for everybody. It's not taking anything out of the general fund. The users are willing to support it themselves. And I really appreciate the opportunity to testify and hope that the committee can see fit to move this bill on forward.
Thank you, Mr. Somerville. I see no questions. Next, we will move to Ketchikan. David Landis, General Manager, Southern Southeast Regional Aquaculture Association. Mr. Landis, please state your name, affiliation, and begin your testimony.
Good afternoon to the chair and members of the committee. My name is David Landis, General Manager of Southern Southeast Regional Aquaculture Association, or SARA, in Ketchikan. SARA supports HB 80, and we understand that the lion's share of this projected revenue would go to the William Jack Hernandez Hatchery in Anchorage and Ruth Burnett Hatchery in Fairbanks. But the Crystal Lake Hatchery is also owned by the state. That's in Petersburg, and it's operated under contract to the state by SARA. So a portion of the operational funding for Crystal Lake is funded through the surcharge, and this funding is critical to the continued operation of the hatchery. The fish produced at Crystal Lake with this funding are primarily king salmon. The adult salmon from this 700,000 smolt release are caught by anglers all over Southeast. These, along with 100,000 coho, are the fish that are paid for with the surcharge and combined with the Dingle Johnson funds. These aren't the only fish that we produce at Crystal Lake, though. With self-generated funds, SARA also produces an equivalent number of kings that are transported and released in other Southeast locations, and these fish are also caught in large numbers by sport fishers. So keeping Crystal Lake intact with both operational and maintenance funding is very important. The commissioner noted earlier that there's a substantial impact to businesses and individuals throughout the region. The department has a fact sheet that states, and I'll read from that, based on the most recent five-year average of hatchery contribution estimates, nearly 50% of all Alaska hatchery king salmon harvested in Southeast Alaska originate from Crystal Lake Hatchery near Petersburg. The large percentage highlights the importance of the facility when accounting for the total king salmon harvest under the auspices of the U.S.-Canada Pacific Salmon Treaty, which is also quite important to the department. And so echoing Mr. Somerville, I would conclude that this is a user-pays system that's fair and appropriate, and SARA supports the passage of this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Landis. We appreciate you being here. I see no questions from the committee, so we will move next to Suzanne Doherty from Ketchikan. Please state your name, affiliation, and begin your testimony.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to address you today. My name is Susan Doherty. I live in Ketchikan. I'm an executive director of Southeast Alaska Seiners Association, known as SEAS. SEAS supports this legislation. No matter the final surcharge, the hundreds of millions of dollars in infrastructure in the three states sport fish hatcheries needs to be maintained and upgraded as appropriate. Additional revenues to Southeast to produce king salmon is also vitally important. Paying the bond debt early and then the pandemic led to this, what I would call scrambling to fill the void that that fortunate event caused. There needs to be a revenue source for these and perhaps other fishery activities. And reenacting the surcharge in some form has been a proven mode to generate needed capital. I thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today.
Thank you, Ms. Doherty. We appreciate you being here. I see no questions. So next we will move to Soldotna, Mr. Ben Moore again with the Executive Director of the Kenai River Sport Fishing Association. Mr. Moore, please state your name, affiliation, and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the House Finance Committee. For the record, my name is Ben Moore. I'm the Executive Director of the Kenai River Sport Fishing Association, or KRSA. Testifying today to register KRSA's support for HB 80 as proposed by the governor, we don't necessarily agree with the language of the amendments added to the bill in a previous committee, which adds an additional $2.50 to the surcharge. I believe by now this committee is familiar with the history of the sport fish license surcharge, that the surcharge fell off last year because bonds which were issued for sport fish hatcheries were repaid early. As I mentioned before, the hunting and fishing communities have acted for nearly 100 years to support the user pays model for fishing game conservation and management, and this case is no different. The sport fishery, whether it's in freshwater or salt, directly benefits from Alaska's sport fish hatcheries. This is the central reason why we support the governor's bill, which introduces a surcharge on sport fish licenses, the funds of which are specifically dedicated to supporting sport fishing activities. Our understanding is these funds will be specifically used for operations and maintenance on the costs of sport fish hatcheries across the state. And that's the critical portion of the bill, in our opinion, that the funds generated from sport fish licenses stay with the users. It's also the nature of our opposition to some of the language in the amendments, which essentially pour money into the department that are fairly vague on how and where that money will be used. Should the committee and the body desire to keep that money above and beyond the governor's request, we would ask that it goes towards access and opportunity, specifically to the construction or maintenance of capital improvements that directly support sport fishing access or sport fishing activities that aren't authorized under AS 1605-130, the hatchery program. Under the governor's proposal, the average Alaska fisherman would have seen a net $5 reduction in annual licenses between last year and next year, while maintaining services provided by the Department of Fish and Game. We recognize the challenges the department has in light of reduced revenues due to COVID, and the money generated from the earlier surcharge didn't go to general operations. So by contributing to O&M, the sport fish community continues to cover its own costs. Thank you for considering this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Moore. I see no questions. Next, we will move. Pardon me, Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Moore?
Yes.
Mr. Moore, I think there was some testimony as to the reason for the added surcharge was to help at least partially address the invasive species issue. Does your organization see any benefit for the state trying to address invasive species?
Mr. Moore?
Yes, Representative Ortiz, through the chair. Thank you for the question. We do see the benefit of managing Alaska's invasive species problem. It certainly is an issue, and we've been supportive of efforts by your colleagues to advance taking care of invasive species in Alaska. Our issue in this bill is that the $2.50 church surcharge, which includes invasive species management, isn't specific to how it's going to impact invasive species within the sport fishing community. Invasives affect all users of the resource, not just sport fishermen.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Moore. Next, we will move to Palmer, Rod Arno, the Policy Director of the Alaska Outdoor Council. Mr. Arno, please state your name, affiliation, and begin your testimony.
Yes, thank you. My name is Rod Arno, Palmer, Alaska, and I'm the Policy Director for the Alaska Outdoor Council. 10,000 Alaskan residents statewide recreate, hunt, fish, trap on public lands. Thank you, Co-Chairman and committee members, for the opportunity to give testimony in support of the governor's proposed legislation in HB 80. The Outdoor Council was present when the Fairbanks senator got the bond package together to get the two sport fish hatcheries in operation. And at that time, there were a number of folks that were concerned at that time whether, once the bonds were paid off, whether then the fees would go away. And so that's why, you know, that was a piece of the legislation to make sure there was a complete closeout. Well, all of the AOC members who participated at the original time to have the additional surcharge fee and also have the subaccount in the Fish and Game Fund are supportive now of going ahead and changing the Alaska Sport Fish Enterprise account, which was mainly about constructing the two hatcheries, to the Sport Fish Enhancement account. We know legally that as far as it being a sub-account of the Fish and Game Fund, that in 2017 we were able to go ahead and have a sub-account, and it has operated successfully. That's in, we'll talk about that in Senate Bill 22, but the Sustainable Wildlife Account. So these accounts work, and the outdoor community is supportive of going ahead and helping to pay for the management of resources that they personally benefit from. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Arno. I see no questions from the committee. Our last testifier in Juneau, Katie Harms from Douglas Island Pink and Chum Incorporated. Ms. Harms, please state your name, affiliation, and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of House Finance. For the record, my name is Katie Harms, and I'm the Executive Director of Douglas Island Pink and Chum, better known as DIPAC, in Juneau. DIPAC is a private nonprofit corporation with the primary mission to sustain and enhance the valuable salmon resources of the state of Alaska for the economic, social, and cultural benefit of all citizens. I'd like to take this time to register DIPAC's support for House Bill 80 and provide a brief history of the sport fishing programs we operate through funds from ADF&G's sport fish division that are currently almost 90% supported by the sport fish license fee surcharge. Prior to 1994, the Alaska Department of Fish and Game produced Chinook salmon to enhance the Juneau area recreational fisheries. These fish were raised at the then state-owned Snedisham hatchery, or it is still state-owned Snedisham hatchery, and were released at selected sites in the Juneau area. In 1994, Snedisham was converted to a sockeye salmon production facility, and the Juneau Chinook program was transferred to DIPAC's Macaulay Salmon Hatchery. Since that time, DIPAC has received just over $300,000 yearly for this sport fish enhancement program. Without these outside funds, the Chinook program would never have gotten off the ground at DIPAC. The ADF&G-funded DIPAC-produced Chinook program has become a staple sport fishery in Juneau for resident and non-resident marine sport and shoreside fishermen. With wild Chinook stocks in decline in Southeast Alaska, the opportunity to catch hatchery-raised Chinook salmon is more important than ever for all fishermen. Due to current financial uncertainty associated with poor salmon returns in Southeast Alaska, the DIPAC Chinook program will likely be greatly reduced in the upcoming year if no surcharge licensee revenues can be established this session. Thank you for the time to speak today, and thank you for consideration of this important issue.
Thank you, Ms. Harms. I see no questions from the committee, and I see no one else in the room or online who wishes to testify. So with that, I'm going to close public testimony. Are there any other questions from the committee regarding HB 80? I see none. So we will hear HB 80 at a future meeting. Amendments for this bill are also due to my office by the end of the day Saturday. Next on the agenda is an introduction of Senate Bill 22, repealing the termination date of the intensive management surcharge repeal by Senator Rivak. Senator Rivak, if you and your staff would like to have a seat at the table, place yourself on the record and begin your introduction.
All right. Good morning, Chair Merrick and members of the House Finance Committee. For the record, Senator Josh Rivak, District M, I'm honored to be here to present SB 22, and thank you very much for hearing our bill. SB 22 is an act repealing the termination date of the intensive management hunting license surcharge. This was asked for by the sportsman community, and I think that means a lot when a group says that they want to pay their own way. This is a revenues bill. It brings in funds for the state, matching funds. Intensive management, what this bill says is that intensive management will continue to be directly sourced from this surcharge as opposed to general fund appropriations, which we do have an obligation to conduct intensive management in the state of Alaska. Importantly, it will be used to leverage Pittman-Robertson's 75-25 matching funds. So $1 million from this hunting license surcharge brings in $3 million, which, of course, now, given tourism, is more important than any time ever, I think, to our Department of Fish and Game. This program has been working well. Again, this just eliminates the sunset for this program, so we've had plenty of time to watch it work. Again, the sportsman community, we haven't heard any opposition to this. Folks seem to appreciate it. It brings in federal dollars and helps support. Most importantly, it helps support healthy game populations with moose, caribou, and deer in the state of Alaska so that we can continue to harvest those animals to feed our families. So with that, if you don't mind, Madam Chair, I will turn it over to my aide, Emma.
Ms. Torkelson.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Co-Chair Merrick and members of the House Finance Committee. For the record, Emma Torkelson, staff to Senator Rivak. So as Senator Rivak stated, SB 22 removes the sunset date of the intensive management surcharge placed on hunting licenses. So the intensive management program identifies when a moose, caribou, or deer population becomes at risk of falling below a sustainable enough level to allow for hunting of that population. At that point, the program then identifies the root cause of the population decrease and then develops and implements a plan for rectifying the issue. Most often, the plans are focused on research. They can also include management such as habitat enhancement. Prior to 2016, this program was funded by capital project appropriations. However, since 2016, the surcharge on hunting licenses plus the matched federal dollars completely covers the cost. In total, the surcharge brings in approximately $1 million in user fees that are then, as Senator Rivak pointed out, leveraged to get another $3 million in Pittman-Robertson match grant money. This $4 million then pays for all of the work of intensive management, but if the surcharge is allowed to sunset, then the state will have to assume the extra cost of the program. The intensive management program protects our wildlife populations and promotes food security across Alaska. By allowing our hunters to access healthy herds. SB 22 ensures that it can continue to be self-sustainable and user-funded, and we appreciate the opportunity to present and the committee's support. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions? Representative Josephson.
Through the chair, thank you for the presentation. I want to clarify, I've been told repeatedly that the Pittman-Robertson dollars can't be used to match actual predator control, only other parts of the program. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, I believe we have Mr. Eddie Grasser online, who I think could speak a little bit better to that.
I do not see Mr. Grasser, but I see Commissioner Vincent Lang. Commissioner, can you help Representative Josephson with his question?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson. Federal funds can, in certain instances, be used to do predator control. However, in Alaska, the natural diversity guidelines that drive much of federal management in the state of Alaska really preclude the use of federal funds to do predator control on federal lands. And when you do predator control on federal lands using, I mean, state lands using federal dollars, that opens it up to federal review, which can be cumbersome. So the intent is we do leverage federal dollars to do much of the science associated with predator control activities on that are done on state land. However, we actually do the removal of predators using state dollars because we don't want the interference or the oversight by the federal government on how we do those actual predator removal programs on state lands.
Follow up?
I think for the commissioner, if I might.
Yes, please.
Through the chair, commissioner, in your previous hearings, you said that, and you've sort of just said it again, that IM is not done on federal land. And I guess I'm puzzled by that because intensive management is done on federal lands over the objection often of the federal government. Isn't that right? It's in the paper every month.
Through the chair, right now we are not doing any intensive management on federal land. We actually approached the federal government last year about doing intensive management on federal land near the Mulchatna caribou herd, since that herd is desperately in a predator pit and not providing for even subsistence uses. However, we have not heard back as to whether or not we could enter into a cooperative agreement to do predator control on federal lands. We're doing it on state lands, but not on federal land.
Follow up?
But the, notwithstanding your comment, Commissioner, the National Park Service has noted the shooting of its collared wolves in research programs. I mean, wolves don't know the boundaries. And so there has been huge, huge disputes about this between the two governments, has there not?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, there were wolves that the Park Service had collared on federal land in Tetland Park, but they weren't shot on federal parkland. They were shot when they got into state predator control areas on state land. Yes, there has been conflict largely between the state government and the federal government on predator control programs, but we are operating under the state intensive management law, and the federal government, again, as I said, is managing under natural diversity guidelines, and under their guidelines, they do not endorse predator control on their landscapes, and we are not doing any on their landscapes. We're doing it adjacent to some of their landscapes, but none on their landscapes that I'm aware of.
Follow up?
Can you, Commissioner, can you define for the committee the difference between intensive management and predator control? I'm assuming that predator control is a subset or a type of intensive management. Is that right?
Through the chair, yes, intensive management is anything that we do to intensively manage those populations to increase their productivity for human use. So in some cases, we are doing intensive management on federal lands, but not predator control. For instance, we are doing cooperative habitat restoration programs on the Kenai Peninsula in cooperation with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service aimed at fire breaks and a variety of other habitat improvements that will hopefully over the long term result in greater moose populations. However, we're not doing any wolf population control on federal lands on the Kenai Peninsula. So intensive management is a broader spectrum that could go from habitat manipulation on the landscape, could go to fire controls on the landscape, and could go to actual removal of predators. And predator removal is one subset of intensive management.
Follow up?
On the subject of the Kenai Peninsula, at what point does, for example, the liberalizing of brown bear baiting on the Kenai become de facto predator control?
Through the chair, I was part of the discussions regarding brown bear baiting on the Kenai Peninsula, and that was a more complex discussion than just intensive management of bears. That was really more focused on trying to deal with the number of bears on state land that were basically causing human-bear interactions on the Kenai Peninsula. And there was a large outcry from citizens of the Kenai Peninsula that were with the number of bears that are around. So the Board of Game decided to actually do some bear removals of numbers to try to get down and reduce and deal with those human-bear interactions. the collateral of that, they recognized that there would potentially be a benefit to increased number of moose on the Kenai Peninsula due to reduced number of bears. But I think their primary driver, given that they couldn't do intensive management across the entire landscape of the Kenai Peninsula, that on federal lands, that it was more to remove the number of bears and get the bear number stabilized so that they reduce human-bear interactions.
If I might.
Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for indulging this. I guess my concern, Commissioner, with the program is that I'm not sure that people understand, and I don't mean to patronize them, they're sophisticated people, but the variety of ways that have been invented and enhanced in the last, since 1994, to undergo predator control when they pay the surcharge. They're just paying the surcharge. But are they, is it your sense that hunters are aware of all the liberal practices, both as legalized hunting, but also as predator control? Do you think they're aware of the smorgasbord of ways that our laws authorize the taking of predators?
Through the chair, well, based on the number of emails and phone conversations I have, I think there is a relatively good awareness of it. It's in the papers quite a bit. I suspect people are relatively aware of what's going on. A little background. So the way intensive management occurs is we have an obligation under the statute to report back to the Board of Game when a population is not meeting its population objectives or its harvest objectives. At that point in time, we then report to the Board of Game that we are underachieving their objectives that they set as a public regulatory body, because those aren't set by the department. Those are set by the Board of Game. At that point in time, the Board of Game tasked us with coming up with an intensive management plan. And during that planning, we evaluate the population. We evaluate the intensive management strategies we have at our disposal. If it's mostly federal land, we probably, and there's a little habitat chance to improve habitat, we likely report back to the Board of Game that it's not feasible in that area, and it moves off, and they deal with it through other levels of means to get the population back up. In other cases where we determine that predator control may work, we actually put together a proposal that the Board of Game again reviews, and all the advisory committees across the state have an opportunity to weigh in. And only after that is approved by the Board of Game do we actually go into the implementation phase of an intensive management program, which, if it includes a program to actually reduce the number of wolves or bears on the landscape, that we actually go out and implement it. Then we have an obligation every year to report back on progress on that plan. And if the plan is not working, the board can reverse that plan, as it did in Unit 16 about 10 or 8 years ago. And so it's not just something we go out and implement. It's constantly initiated by the Board of Game. It's constantly reviewed by the department and the Board of Game to make sure it's meeting its objectives. And if it's not, we walk away from it and move on to the next area.
Thank you.
All throughout that process, the public has an opportunity to weigh in.
Thank you. Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I suppose I should have probably just addressed this as a point of order. I don't think that the understanding of the current regulations and how management is being conducted here, the understanding of the Kenai people of the Kenai Peninsula is germane to the discussion that we're having today on the bill. And thus, I would like to point out that the people of Kenai are probably fully aware of understanding how the state is managing the resources, and we shouldn't be questioning whether they do or don't in this committee. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Carpenter. Senator Rivak.
And Madam Chair, thank you. And if I could, I think it's really important to remember that predator control is such a small piece of what intensive management is. It includes, as a commissioner, I think, sort of alluded to, everything from research to controlled burns to habitat, all different aspects of habitat. And so if I recall, it was under 1% last year of what we're talking about went to predator control. So while it is a piece of this, it's a very, very small piece. So
thank you, Senator. With that, we're going to go back to Commissioner Vincent Lang from the Department of Fish and Game for some invited testimony. Commissioner, please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Okay. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Doug Vincent Lang, and I am the commissioner for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today about Senate Bill 22. The Alaska legislature recognized the importance of wild game meat to Alaskans as a food source, and consistent with Article 8, Section 4 of the Alaska Constitution, passed the Intensive Management Law in 1994. This law requires ADF&G and the Alaska Board of Game to identify moose, caribou, and deer populations that are especially important food sources and to ensure that the populations remain large enough to provide food security for Alaskans through an adequate sustained harvest. Recognizing the potential for federal interference in state IM programs, the department funded its IM programs under the IM law from a series of capital budgets. As the capital funds were expended and new funds were not allocated, hunters became concerned about the future of intensive management in Alaska. Because of the success of several state-run conducted IM programs in increasing ungulate, principally caribou and moose, populations on state lands, hunters requested an intensive management surcharge be added to their licenses. This was at the request of hunters across the state of Alaska. The request was made to ensure that funds were dedicated and available to assess and conduct intensive management activities, especially given the reluctance of federal managers to conduct intensive management on their lands or using federal funds. The legislature agreed and added intensive management surcharge to hunting licenses in 2016, and the surcharge has been collected since January 1, 2017, and has been used to fulfill our obligations under the state IM law. Intensive management programs that enhance habitat or manage for predators are a core element of game management on state lands. I emphasize that IM programs also include habitat enhancement in addition to predator control. We have done several habitat enhancement projects across Alaska aimed at improving ungulate numbers. In addition to reliable funding, careful planning is essential to ensuring our state IM programs are both effective and defendable. All state intensive management programs are guided by an intensive management protocol that ensures decisions are based on the best available science. Intensive management allows us to put food on the table of Alaskans and is one of the priorities of me as commissioner, and are essential to meeting subsistence needs, the department's first priority. Just look at the success we have had in meeting the food needs of Alaskans in the 40-mile caribou herd. This herd, restored through our IM efforts, put over $2.6 million of healthy meat in the freezers of Alaskans. I refer to a handout each of you should have. These surcharge funds also ensure that we can implement the state IM law without interference of federal oversight. And I remind you that two-thirds of Alaska lands are federal lands and are off-limits to intensive management activities as they are managed for their natural diversity, not human use, despite a rural subsistence priority. And there is no assurance one can feed one's family under natural diversity objectives. The legislation before you today repeals the sunset on the intensive management surcharge. This proposal does not have any additional cost to the department. Should the surcharge sunset, the department will see a significant decrease in revenue to pay for intensive management and our ability to meet our obligations under the intensive management law. Revenue from the IM surcharge totaled approximately $1 million in each of the last three calendar years. Most of those funds are used to match Pittman-Robertson dollars at a 1-to-3 ratio. That means absent an appropriation for the match, the department could stand to lose nearly $4 million, hampering the department's ability to conduct IM activities. With that, I urge your support for this important piece of legislation. I'd be happy to answer any more questions you may have and have other staff that I can call on as a lifeline if I don't have the answer. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. Are there questions? Representative Wohl.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I don't know who this question is for, but I guess I'm going to circle back to some of the points that Representative Josephson made. And in the presentation of the bill, and I'm sorry, I forgot, Senator Rivek, I forgot your staffer's name, Ms.
Torkelson.
Torkelson. Thank you. You read about intensive management, and you said funds are used for research and management and habitat enhancement. I don't believe I heard you say predator control, and I don't know if that was a deliberate or accidental omission. And I know it's a small percentage of the FY20, and if you go back to 19 or 18, it's a bigger percentage. And I'm not trying to belabor the point, but as many people know, this is a controversial topic. So to sort of gloss over it and say, well, it's only, you know, so many million dollars, 0.02, and 18 it was $0.18 million. So the money isn't really the principal, and I think it's important to touch upon it, and because it is controversial, and many of us hear from people that don't agree with aerial hunting of wolves or gassing of wolf pups in their dens. And that's, I think, what Representative Joseph was alluding to when he said, does everyone realize that some of these funds go to these methodologies? And I know this has been going on. I know it's been controversial, and it came up during the commissioner's confirmation, and it's going to continue to be an issue. So I guess if you're going to say what these funds are going towards, habitat enhancement, research and management, and predator control, because even if it's not a large part of the budget, it is part of the budget, and I think it should be discussed and open and be open about it. Thank you.
Senator Rivak?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. And while that is a consideration, as the commissioner mentioned, these programs are statutory currently. They have to fund intensive management. So right now, so I think if we were going to address that issue, we felt like it would be appropriate to address it separately. Currently, intensive management has to be funded, and so what we're saying is it would be better for it to be a user fee than a UGF.
Thank you, Representative Rasmussen.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I just wanted to speak to Representative Carpenter's point of order and highlight that the one-page, four-line bill in front of us only refers to a termination date for the intensive management hunting license surcharge, and it's not really germane to speak to some of the topics that we are speaking to at this point, so hopefully we can keep that point of order in mind.
Thank you, Representative Rasmussen. Representative Wohl.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. With all due respect, we got a handout for this bill that mentions the aforementioned items. So to not be able to, saying it's not germane, it's right here on paper in front of me. So I disagree with that point. I think it's very, pardon the pun, fair game to talk about it.
Thank you, and I'd like to recognize at 2:25 p.m. we were joined by Representative Kronk. Thank you for being here. Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Because, we are obligated to perform intensive management program, why was in 2016, when the fee was put forward, why was there a sunset date in the first place? In other words, this is just eliminating the sunset date. Can you speak to why it was there, put there in the first place?
Senator Rivak.
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Ortiz, I wasn't here during the passage of the initial bill. I don't know if the commissioner could speak to that or not, sir.
Commissioner, can you speak to that question from Representative Ortiz?
Yeah, I was around but wasn't intimately involved with it. If I remember correctly, what happened was that there was, I think, the same amount of angst you have about predator control and a variety of other things, and I think the compromise was built to leave the sunset in place to see whether or not it was working or not working so that you could have this discussion again in the future.
Thank you.
Thank you. I see no further questions. So with that, I'm going to open public testimony on Senate Bill 22. Is there anyone in the room wishing to testify? Seeing no one, we will move online. First online, we have Rod Arno, Policy Director of the Alaska Outdoor Council in Soldotna. Mr. Arno, please state your name, affiliation, and begin your testimony.
Yes, my name is Rod Arno. I'm the Policy Director for the Alaska Outdoor Council, calling in from Palmer. Thank you, Madam Chair, House Finance Committee members, for the opportunity to testify for the Outdoor Council. And the Outdoor Council was on hand in Juneau in 2016 with the other major conservation organizations in the state, SCI, Territorial Sportsmen, and the Alaska Professional Hunters, to get together and agree to having our licenses, our hunting and fishing license, raised in order to help pay for management of fishing game. At that time, section of HB 137, section 22, created the intensive management surcharge. And when it did that, it also also created how that funding source could be gathered and used specifically for intensive management projects. And that's AS 1605-130G. And it created a sustainable wildlife account that AOC members and the members of the other major conservation organizations all willingly agreed to be part of the legislation when we asked for the legislature to go ahead and allow us to pay more for our opportunity to personally gather a wild food harvest. The reasoning for the sunset was, again, you know, the apprehension of some folks how intensive management would be implemented by different administrations and how it would be received by the public through the board process. And our membership at this date, here we are 4 years later, are pleased with the way the department has dispensed these funds from the special sub-account, and all the hunters, excluding the $5 low-income resident hunting license, they do not have to pay the $10 fee. All non-residents pay a $30 non-resident fee on top of their hunting or trapping license. So the Outdoor Council's 10,000 members are more than willing to continue to help pay for the state services of management that allows for an increase in harvestable surplus, because right now food security is much more in the news and much more important than it is the concerns on some of the methods of predator control. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Arno. We appreciate your testimony today. I'd like the record to please reflect that at 2:28 p.m. we were joined by Representative McCabe. Thank you for being with us. Next for public testimony is Mr. Mark Richards with the Resident Hunters of Alaska in Fairbanks. Mr. Richards, please state your name, affiliation, and begin your testimony.
Can you hear me okay, Madam Chair?
Yes, we can. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. And good afternoon, Chair Merrick and members of the House Finance Committee. For the record, my name is Mark Richards. I'm the Executive Director of Resident Hunters of Alaska. And I'm calling today in support of SB 22 for nearly 3,000 members from across the state. I want to start out by mentioning that I understand and respect that some legislators have issues with predator control in general, and I'm always happy to discuss those issues with anyone outside of the meeting. However, you know, intensive management is a law, and the border game is required, mandated, to follow that law and to do intensive management when necessary. Having said that, most of what goes into intensive management does not involve predator control efforts and can be funded in part by matching 3-to-1 federal Pittman-Robertson dollars, which right now are growing substantially with the new administration. So such things, you know, that the department has to do anyway, we can be helped by this surcharge continuing. And that involves everything from aerial population surveys, animal health monitoring, you know, measuring rump fat depth, fecal samples, habitat surveys. All of those kind of things are necessary just so the department can inform the Board of Game what kind of opportunities hunters can have, how much game can be taken sustainably. So I encourage all of you to vote to support this bill. There's no reason to oppose it. Opposing it would only lead to less funding that we can get from the federal PR funds for the work that helps all hunters, regardless if predator control isn't even done. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Richards. I see no questions. We'd like to have the record reflect at 2:32 p.m. we were joined by Representative Rauscher. Thanks for being with us today, Mr. Rauscher. Next, we have John Sturgeon in Anchorage, the director of the Safari Club International Alaska chapter. Mr. Sturgeon, please state your name, affiliation, and begin your testimony.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. This is John Sturgeon, and I'm representing the Safari Club of Alaska today. We support Senate Bill 22 and agree it should be made permanent. We believe it has been of great assistance to Alaska Department Fish and Game in the proper management of Alaska's wildlife resources. Harvesting wild game is a practice steeped in tradition and is extremely important to Alaska families. Our family, for the last 50 years, was exclusively rely on wild game for our freezer. In fact, in some places, it's a necessity. Without the funds to properly manage wildlife as a food source, this food source could be drastically reduced or in some cases completely lost. And again, this is very, very important in bush Alaska. Intensive management funds help assure Alaska's hunting traditions, and the ability to fill our freezers with healthy, sustainable wild game will continue. An intensive surcharge, as mentioned earlier, was added to hunting license in 2016 and has been collected since January 1st, 2017. Because these programs have proven successful in increasing caribou, moose, and deer populations, hunters requested the surcharge to ensure the funds were dedicated and available to assess and conduct intensive management activities. The license revenue allows the department to carry out projects free of interference from the federal government. This also frees up funds that can be leveraged using Pittman Robinson money at a 3-to-1 match, which has been mentioned before, thereby helping to mitigate provision of federal dollars and fills gaps where Pittman Robinson cannot be used. Most hunters that pay this surcharge do so without hesitation or regret. Hunters realize the value of proper management of our wildlife resources. With the budget crisis is facing the state of Alaska currently, we must find new and innovative ways to fund our essential programs. Alaska hunters are willing to do our share and step up and help with that funding. So once again, the Safari Club of Alaska would like to express our strong and unequivocal support for the continuation of the intensive management program and making it permanent. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify today, Madam Chair and other committee members. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Sturgeon. We appreciate your testifying. I see no questions, and I see no one else online. With that, I'm going to close public testimony. Next, Rachel Hankey, Legislative Liaison, and Dana Mackey, Administrative Services Director of the Department of Fish and Game, are online to speak on the fiscal note. Ms. Hankey?
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, this is Rachel Hankey, Legislative Liaison for the Department of Fish and Game. This fiscal note reflects the changes in revenues to the Fish and Game Fund starting in FY23 at $500,000 because of that December 22 repeal date. So it would be from December 22 going forward, and then $1 million in the out years.
Thank you. Are there questions regarding the fiscal note? Seeing none, are there questions regarding the bill? Seeing none, we will continue the bill hearing for this at a later date, and amendments for this bill will also be due to my office by the end of the day on Saturday. Senator Rivak and Ms. Torkelson, thank you for coming to House Finance today, and we'll set this bill aside and we'll take an at ease to change presentations. Thank you. Brief at ease. House Finance back on the record. The next bill before the committee today is House Bill 126, extending the Board of Public Accountancy by Representative Thompson, his staff Tom Wright. Representative Thompson, if you'd place yourself on the record and begin your presentation.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. My name is Steve Thompson. I represent House District 2 out of Fairbanks. And I'd like to thank the Finance Committee and the co-chairs for hearing House Bill 126 today. Basically, House Bill 126 extends the Alaska State Board of Public Accountancy for 8 years through June 30th of 2029, as recommended by the legislative audit of April 8, 2020. Legislative audit conducted a review of the board, concluding that the board served the public interest by conducting meetings in accordance with state laws, amending certain regulations to improve the public accountancy occupation, and effectively licensing and regulating certified public accountants and partnerships, corporations engaged in the practice of public accountancy. Extending the Board of Public Accountancy is critical in protecting the public interest by ensuring that only qualified persons are licensed and that appropriate standards of competency and practice are established and enforced. I should disclose also that my wife is a prior member of the Board of State Board of Accountancy, so I wanted to get that on the record. And then in the room we have Chris Curtis, our legislative auditor. He was here to discuss the audit. And also online we have Leslie Schmidt, a member of the board, and Don Ruling from Anchorage to provide comments and answer questions should there be any. Thank you.
Thank you. Take a brief at ease. House Finance back on the record. Next, we'll have Legislative Auditor Chris Curtis come up and go over the audit for us. Ms. Curtis.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Chris Curtis. I'm your State Legislative Auditor, and I believe you all have a copy of the Sunset Audit of the Board of Public Accountancy. I do want to draw your attention to the transmittal letter. Because I am a CPA and my staff are CPAs, this audit was not conducted in accordance with government with auditing standards. It was except for the standard of independence, which we do not meet since we are CPAs. So we should disclose that. Again, as already discussed, we did find that this board was serving the public's interest by conducting their meetings in accordance with law and by effectively licensing CPAs and partnerships and corporations engaged in public accountancy. We are recommending an 8-year extension. You will find the standard licensing statistics on page 8 of the audit. Exhibit 2 on page 5 of the audit, Exhibit 2 shows that there are 1,328 active licenses and permits as of January 2020. When compared to the prior Sunset audit in 2012, that represents a 10% increase. And when we were following up the increase, we found that Alaska was one of the few states that do not require a Social Security number for licensure. So consequently, there are a high number of international applicants. If you turn the page to page 7, you'll see the schedule of revenues and expenditures. As of the end of FY19, there was a surplus of over $84,000. And the fees are on page 8. So we make one recommendation for improvements, and that begins on page 11. We recommend DCBPLs, and that's the Division of Corporation Business and Professional Licensing, that their chief investigator ensure investigations are completed timely. So for this board, there were 101 complaints opened during the audit period, and 40 of them took over 6 months to complete. So that's 40%. Auditors reviewed five of the 40 and found two of them had unjustified periods of inactivity that ranged from 64 days to 219 days. According to staff, the inactivity was the result of turnover and competing priorities. So moving on to management's response to the audit, you'll see that beginning on page 21. The Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development's commissioner agrees with the report conclusions, except for the conclusion that 40% of investigations took over 6 months to complete. The commissioner states that the Division of Corporations, Business, and Professional Licensing has no control over how an investigation will unfold or how long it will take, and that it does not have a policy to complete all investigations within a specific time frame. However, the commissioner does agree to authorize an additional investigative supervisor to help with the caseloads. The commissioner also took exception regarding our conclusion that the use of technology impacted board operations and believes that the technological tools have been successful for all boards. The board's chair response is on page 25. The chair doesn't disagree with any of the report conclusions, but does take the opportunity to highlight a disagreement that the board has with the department regarding should be considered essential travel. And that's.
Are there questions for Ms. Curtis? Representative Josephson.
Through the chair, Ms. Curtis, looking at the April 8th, 2020 audit, hopefully I can talk about the audit. Madam Chair, is that okay? Is that?
Yes, Representative Josephson.
This bill is just about a single year change, but we'll talk about the audit. The audit says that there were 101 board-related cases over a four-year span, and you said there are 300. How many accountants are there?
As of January, through the chair, Representative Josephson, as of January 2020, there are 1,328 active licenses and permits.
Follow-up?
Should we be concerned, even if it's DCBPL's problem, should that be cause for a shorter period of extension?
Representative Josephson, through the chair, the criteria we use to evaluate the sunset process includes the efficiency to which the complaints are addressed. Occupational boards, some occupations have continuing education requirements, so you could have investigations concerning that, which may most people would consider less concerning than maybe malpractice or something like that. So no, we did not take into consideration the number of complaints specifically, rather the efficiency aspect of how long it was taking to complete the investigations.
Follow up?
Given that the cost of a two-year license is much less than we saw with another profession yesterday, could there be a fee increase? Not through this bill, of course, although theoretically it would meet the single subject rule, I guess, but a fee increase and a requirement for the hiring of additional PCNs as investigators.
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, I think that might be a question for maybe Director Chambers, as far as we did not look about what type of policy could be put in place. It wasn't the subject of the audit, but possibly the department might have a view on that.
Ms. Chambers, can you help Representative Josephson with his question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, this is Sarah Chambers, Director of the Division of Corporations Business and Professional Licensing. And yes, Representative Josephson, through the chair, your suggestion that we could raise fees, increase fees to hire additional staff is a sound suggestion. We have actually already added an investigator to our team of 19 investigators, which cover
all 43 of our professional licensing programs plus business licensing investigations. So we are already augmenting our team to try to address some of our workload concerns as noted in these audits. And because our investigators charge only to the programs as they're working them, if there is an increase in, for example, CPA casework, then the CPA program will be charged that amount, which could lead to an increase in fees.
Thank you. Representative Rasmussen.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. This question's probably for Director Chambers. It looks like the by the end of January 31st, 2020, the board anticipates a surplus of $531,524. And I was just curious what happens with the money. Does the board remain in control of that money? Or, I mean, I guess they're not in control, but does it stay with that board?
Ms. Chambers?
Yes, thank you. Through the chair, Representative Rasmussen, all of our professional licensing boards retain any surplus or deficit that they experience, and that is carried forward from fiscal year to fiscal year. So we are required by Alaska Statute 0801065 to do a fee analysis and set fees so there isn't too high of a surplus or deficit. So as a program grows in a surplus, then we'll likely reduce the fees, and they'll work on eating up that surplus as their expenses are charged to the program. Conversely, if there is a deficit, then we will likely increase fees to keep that program from sinking further into deficit. So those fees are never swept, and they're always retained for use for these specific licensing programs' expenses.
Follow up?
Thank you. So I guess my question then is the letter that we just, it was just brought to our awareness about the travel for the board. I guess I'm confused why a board with a $530,000 projected surplus is not granted the opportunity for travel to meetings that the board determines fit. I don't know if that needs statutory, regulatory change, or is that just a decision from the department?
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Rasmussen, again, Sarah Chambers, the fiscal authority, the expenditure authority, for each board actually is not set according to each board. It's set at the division level. So when the state budget goes through through the legislative process and is set, we are allocated for all of our licensing programs a specific amount of expenditure authority, and each board is not allocated that independent authority by the legislature. So just because a board may have a surplus doesn't mean that we have the expenditure authority from the legislature to spend that much money during a fiscal year. So hopefully that makes sense.
Thank you. Thank you. Representative Wohl.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I think I answered my own question, but there's the 40% on page 6. There's 101 cases opened, and 40 were open for over 180 days, meaning they took too long to process. And that you're nodding as if that's I'm so far so good, right?
Ms. Curtis?
Representative Rule, through the chair, there whether or not it's too long for a specific case, depending on the priority of the case, another type of work that a division might have and how they juggle their competing priorities on a case-by-case basis. We noted that overall for the board, 40% seems fairly high.
Follow up? Thank you. And it's just coincidence that you reviewed five, and again, 40% of those five had periods of unjustified inactivity. I guess, inclusive within that 180 days. And it mentioned staff turnover, but this is the board staff, right? This has nothing to do with DCBPL, correct?
No, through Representative Wolf, through the chair. This is the investigative function is carried out within DCBPL, and these are division staff.
Follow up?
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Sounds like deja vu all over again, but from the other board we heard from, midwives, and it sounds like that these boards are getting sort of called out for taking too long, but it's having to do with the staff at DCBPL, which is sort of out of their control. Is that correct?
Yes, Representative Wohl, you'll note that the recommended term of extension is not impacted by the recommendation, but we do highlight it as an area for improvement.
Follow up.
More of a theoretical question, but does DCBPL get audited?
Through the chair, they get audited as part of the sunset process as support to the board. So every time we go in and look at a board, we look at their also DCBPL support, their licensing assistance, you know, the processing of all the applications. That is not done by board members. That's all. You know, this really is, in a large part, an audit of DCBPL every time we look at an occupational board.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I'd like to understand the difference between the fiscal year 17-18-19 licensing fees. And I guess if I understand the chart here on page 7 correctly, July 1 through January 31, there's a large discrepancy in the difference of fees each year. 17 was 179,000, fiscal year 18 was 730,000. I would just like to understand why there's a difference from year to year and the amount of money that is being brought in.
Representative Carpenter, through the chair, they're on a biannual. So every other year they have the renewals. So they have that influx every other year. And then that off year is typically people who are getting licensed in between or then renewing their license. So it's we always evaluate it over a 2 year. And that's why we always at least include at least 3 years to kind of see one licensing cycle.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Edgman.
Thank you. A couple of questions. So, Ms. Curtis, I know because I've been on this committee for a few years that you have done many audits, and I've seen a number of these bills come through over time. It's interesting. We've had four bills in the last 2 days with varying fees, wildly varying in my estimation. Is it your experience that these user fees are they're established, right, sort of board by board, by entity, with no regard to sort of any kind of uniformity in terms of standards or benchmarking? Or, I mean, all the fees occur, like for the bill that we're addressing now, under the realm of the Board of Public Accountancy, not as how it relates to sports or fishing or midwives like we had yesterday. It's kind of a vague question, but, I mean, is that your understanding? It's just sort of done per entity to the next entity and thereon?
Representative Edgman, through the chair. Actually, yeah, there is a statute that says you have to set the fee to cover the cost of regulation. So they actually track the cost of regulating each occupation. And so the variance in fees you see is the variance in regulating the occupation, oftentimes driven by investigations, what you saw yesterday with the midwives. So if you have a large number of licensees, board of nursing, those are going to tend to be lower, because you have so many economies of scale. When you have the smaller number of licensees, they tend to be larger.
Representative Edgman.
Okay, well that's helpful and helps me understand why the Board of Midwives would. You know, it's a two-year fee of $3,800 versus sports fishing license and non-resident fees are $100, $200 range, and then a long schedule for the Board of Accountancies that I don't even want to spend the time to try to understand. But my second question is, if the reverse sweep doesn't occur, this money gets swept into the general fund. Is that correct?
Representative Edgman, no. There is no sub-fund of the general fund that's subject to sweep that this money goes into. These fees go right into the general fund. And as Director Chambers stated, the appropriation to expend to regulate these is at the division level and is general funded. These fees are not dedicated revenue, couldn't have dedicated revenue, so they actually go into the general fund. There is no, and there's no separate tracking of them at the sub-fund level.
So this would not be subjected to the annual vote on reverse sweep then?
Yep.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Josephson.
Through the chair, a follow-up on that. The general fund is sweepable, is it not?
Representative Josephson, through the chair. Certain sub-funds of the general fund are sweepable.
Follow-up?
In, you know, this is a subject of great interest.
Mm-hmm.
In July 2019, in the other body's finance committee, I think in a couple of hearings that July, there was discussion of how, I mean, I've heard this in many hearings about how these dollars could be swept away, and there was consideration of the legal consequences of that. But now, deferring to Ms. Representative Rasmussen, I think I'm truly off subject, so I'll leave it alone. Thank you.
Thank you. I see no further questions. Thank you, Ms. Kearse. Representative Wohl.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I just, you, something you said earlier is kind of sticking with me, which is the length of time it takes to process an investigation. You're saying, which we've determined is in part or largely or not so large, but in part to the staffing of the DCBPL. And so you're saying it's not, you're pointing that out, and when you kept the 8-year extension in this because, but yesterday's letter from the midwives, the board chair had to say in her letter of response, in response to item number 2 or whatever it was, as far as the length of time, she had to spell out, well, it wasn't our fault, it was DCBPL. Mm-hmm. So they're sort of being charged with being tardy or deficient in their time response, and it's in DCBPL. And I'm trying to read this letter and see if this same chairperson is saying the same thing, that we don't have control over that. So you're saying, well, no, we're not holding them liable because it's DCBPL, but in their letters of response, they're saying, acting as if they are being held liable.
Representative Wohl, through the chair. Yes, so DCBPL midwives yesterday, the words I chose, because I had to choose them very carefully, was that their term of extension was 2 years, significantly below 8 years, due to an issue we identified during the audit and the board's reluctance to recommend statutory changes in the public's interest because they didn't want to increase their fees, which is not appropriate. So the issue we identified, we could not provide details and I could not address it on record. I am telling you that the separate recommendation I had relating to timeliness investigations did not factor into my recommended extension. However, I also point out that different board, I mean, a health board and investigations, the nature of their investigations and their impact to public safety, I regard as more important and more likely to influence a recommended term of extension, as opposed to public accountancy or barbers and hairdressers or some boards that I don't think have such a tight connection to public health.
Follow up?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I understand. Health, public safety prevails over accountancy, but, and I understand what you're saying about those other issues, but the issue of timeliness was addressed that they had to respond to, and I guess if there's a staff shortage at DCBPL for whatever reason, and it's affecting the timeliness of some of this, then I guess in this report too, although it didn't affect their length of renewal time, it did come up. And I guess I feel like some of these boards maybe are maybe being unfairly not penalized, but sort of called out on something that's beyond their control.
And Representative Wohl, through the chair, I've heard that multiple times, not just from the chairs of the boards, but also from the committee members here. And I do recognize that DCBPL is not the board itself, but it is board support, and this is a legislative oversight mechanism. So I always raise it to legislators' attention when the support isn't as good as it should be, and when we need to come in, and whether that impacts or should impact the timeline of our coming back in to do more legislative oversight. In regards to whether delays are simply a matter of not enough staff, I mean, there's a lot of other things that could impact it. Whether they have good procedures, whether they have good supervision, those types of things that we don't do a deep dive enough to say, this is specifically why this isn't working. I did a deeper dive back in 2005 when I looked at the actual investigative function and found other aspects that were contributing to just how it was organized. So this isn't a specific evaluation of the division of their investigative section. But we do enough work to say, because we're required to, we've got some problems here. And we definitely, with 40%, we think that it could be done faster. And, you know, due process, you'd expect either the cases aren't, if they're not a priority or they can't get the evidence, maybe they should clean it up a little bit and close them out. Maybe that's part of the problem. That's not being done. There's a lot of different things that could contribute to it.
Thank you. Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. So my questions, you were just speaking to them briefly, and we've been talking about money and potential staff shortages and whatnot, and if that would help solve problems. And as I'm looking at your findings here, and specifically regarding to the 40% board investigations and the unjustified inactivity, you specifically state staff turnover, competing priorities, no documentation to show that supervisory reviews are occurring, and you talked about just a second ago good procedures. The case that I see here, if I'm reading between the lines, is better management would potentially address the shortfalls here or the inactivity. Is that a fair statement as you've went through this audit?
Representative Carpenter, I don't think I've done enough deep dive to say specifically what the department should do. We typically ask, you know, why is this the case? And they provide us the cause, competing priorities and turnover. And turnover, I certainly believe, and competing priorities, sure. I think Director Chambers would like to speak to that issue.
Ms. Chambers?
Thank you. Through the chair, again, this is Sarah Chambers, Division Director. Through the chair, Representative Carpenter, management of the investigative process is very important to us, and we do have operating procedures that our team follows. And we agree with the legislative auditor that we can do better, and we have taken steps, as I mentioned earlier, to hire an additional supervisor. We've also adjusted some of our policies and procedures to make sure that we are clarifying priority cases. And so we are focusing on the life, health, and safety cases. But the concern that the auditor found was that our team was not going back and meeting our own procedures as far as documenting case activity. So we are continuing to add resources and double back on ensuring that our investigators and our three-member senior investigator team are ensuring that documentation happens. When that does happen, then on the next audit of any of our programs, because again, this stretches across 21 licensing boards, then the auditors will be able to see that the reasons why a case may have taken too long, according to our own standards, that perhaps a respondent was not forthcoming with information, perhaps we couldn't get a hold of witnesses, if there was staff turnover or competing health and safety priorities, then the auditor would be able to see that and a finding like this would not occur. So we are continuing to improve our management and always appreciate the auditor's feedback.
Thank you. Quick follow-up.
Follow-up?
The question was not at all intended to poke anybody in the eye, only to point out that if if we are not following our own procedures, that is something that we can remedy fairly easily. We just start following our own procedures. And it isn't a discussion of needing more resources, just a will to follow our procedures in some cases. I'm not poking an eye or trying to poke an eye in the administration here, just trying to point out that we've got a solution here. It is mostly management related, not funding related. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Carpenter. Anything further for Ms. Curtis? Representative Josephson.
Through the chair, Ms. Curtis, looking at page 6 of the audit, the 101 board-related cases spanning, I guess, 3.5 years, I'm wondering to what degree these are essentially complaints about an accountant's negligence. You know, I got audited, or I don't like the return. And they don't really, I mean, I can only relate to this to the practice of law, but they don't concern, for example, a missed deadline, which could be negligence as well, or a substance abuse problem, which would be something the board might want to know about. Is there a possibility that these, is there a clearing system where they say, you know, your complaint is not within our jurisdiction. You've got a complaint that doesn't relate to the kinds of things we regulate. Does that make sense?
Through the chair, they definitely do have a process, whether it's not in their jurisdiction or they don't have the evidence to. They do. In the 101, it's complaints or cases. So they have a process to close them out and not pursue them for an investigation. So they have a complaint phase and they have an investigative phase. And one has to meet a threshold before it's actually investigated.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Curtis. We appreciate you being here. And next we're going to move to invited testimony. First, we have Leslie Schmidt, board member on the State Board of Public Accountancy. Ms. Schmidt, please state your name and affiliation for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you to the chair and the House Finance Committee for hearing my testimony today. For the record, my name is Leslie Schmidt. I'm an Anchorage-based CPA and currently serve as chair of the Alaska Board of Public Accountancy. I'm currently serving in my 8th and final year on the board. I would like to thank the legislative audit process for their recommendation of the maximum extension of 8 years for the board. I'd like the committee to know that the board makes every effort to stay interactive with stakeholders and licensees, and we try to foster a lot of outreach to the people that we are either regulating or the people who are looking to us to protect the public safety. We also make every attempt to stay active at the national level to address issues affecting the profession. The board also maintains ongoing projects to update and modernize its statutes and regulations so that we're staying current with how the profession is moving. The Board of Public Accountancy would again like to thank you for hearing this bill, and I'll remain online for any potential questions.
Thank you, Ms. Schmidt. Are there any questions? Seeing none, thank you for your testimony. Next, Don Rulian, former Public Accountancy Board member. Mr. Rulian, please place your name and affiliation on the record and begin your testimony.
Yeah, good afternoon, and thank you for the opportunity to testify before you for HB 126. My name is Don Rulian. I'm currently CPA and founding member of Rulian & Associates, LLC, which is based out of Anchorage. In March of 21, I completed my second four-year term on the State Board of Accountancy, where I've also served as chair of the board. I'm also a past president of the Alaska Society of CPAs, and I'm currently on the Uniform Accountancy Act Committee for the National Association of State Boards of Accountancy. Today, I'm testifying as a past board member and a current member of the Alaska Society of CPAs. I believe the State Board of Public Accountancy is an integral part of providing protection to the public that ensures that all CPAs meet the requirements set forth by our statutes and regulations so that we can continue to protect the public's interests for all the financial matters of concern for them in the future. And I appreciate your hearing this bill and in extending the board's term for another 8 years. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Rulian. Are there questions from the committee? Seeing none, thank you for being with us today. If there are no other questions from the committee, I'm going to open public testimony on HB 126. Is there anyone in the room that would like to testify? Seeing none, we'll move online. First, we have Krista Burston, President and CEO of the Alaska Society of CPAs. Ms. Burston, please state your name, affiliation, and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and good afternoon. My name is Krista Burson, and I'm the President and CEO of the Alaska Society of CPAs based in Anchorage. On behalf of our membership and Board of Directors, we would like to support House Bill 126 and extending the termination date of the Board of Public Accountancy. The Board of Public Accountancy operates in the public's interest and provides appropriate regulatory oversight of CPAs licensed in Alaska. Additionally, the board is inclusive of all interested parties, including the AKCPA. The AKCPA and the Board of Public Accountancy have a very positive and collaborative relationship, and I thank you for your consideration. This concludes my testimony.
Thank you, Ms. Burson. I see no questions. Is there anyone else online that would like to testify? Seeing none, I will close public testimony. Next, we'll move to Director Sarah Chambers to go over the fiscal note, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Again, this is Director Sarah Chambers. And our fiscal note reflects that if the bill does not pass, this board will sunset and there will no longer be the $25,600 necessary to support the activities of the board. So that's why we are including the amount, $25,600, in the out years to support the activities of the board itself. Sometimes extension bills are the fiscal notes for extension bills are not very intuitive. The licensing program itself will continue on if the board were to sunset. So this is not the cost of the licensing program. This is just the cost of board member travel, or if they are able to travel, and advertising of their board meetings and additional meals and incidentals that board members receive when they are traveling. So I'm happy to answer any questions about the fiscal note.
Any questions for Ms. Chambers? Seeing none, thank you, Ms. Chambers. And seeing no further questions, thank you, Representative Thompson. We will bring this bill back up at a later date. Amendments are due to my office by the end of the day Saturday for HB 126.
Thank you.
Thank you. And this concludes our agenda for today. Our next meeting is tomorrow at 9 a.m. where we will hear House Bill 100, extending allocations to the Alaska Workforce Investment Board by Representative Wohl. And with that, at 3:16 p.m., we are adjourned. Thank you.